Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we plunge into the fascinating currents of the world to bring you those aha moments. And today, we're kicking off with something pretty surprising, actually. When was the last time you saw gaming giants like Xbox and PlayStation openly promoting each other's games?
Almost never, right? It feels counterintuitive.
Exactly. Yet in a genuinely unexpected twist, it is happening. The gaming world, well, it's in this incredibly dynamic state of flux, constantly redefining its own rules. Our mission today is to go on a deep dive into your sources. We're like an industry titans making, let's say, strategic peace treaties, live service games, navigating some really complex regulations, and even uncovering clues about the future of gaming hardware. We're going to extract the most important nuggets of knowledge that show us these surprising alliances, the tough decisions being made, and the cutting-edge developments shaping how we play and what we expect.
Exactly. Get ready for some genuine aha moments, because we're going to connect the dots between these diverse stories. By the end of this deep dive, you'll have a clear, concise picture of the powerful, sometimes hidden forces at play in this incredibly dynamic and, well, ever-evolving industry. It's not just about the games anymore. It's the whole ecosystem, and it's far more intertwined than you might think.
So let's unpack this first bit. For decades, the Xbox versus PlayStation rivalry, it defined the landscape. It was this almost binary arms race.
Oh, absolutely. Exclusive franchises, hardware specs, those were the battle line.
But now it feels like that landscape is genuinely shifting, like in a big way. What are you seeing that's really shaking up that traditional competitive model?
Well, what's truly fascinating here, the deepest insight isn't just business logic. It's that the very definition of a console win has changed. It's no longer just about selling the most boxes or the most exclusive. It's about capturing your attention span across every screen you own. For decades, PlayStation wanted you only in their garden. Now, they seem to be realizing they might profit more if they just ensure their best roses are available in every garden you visit, so to speak. So we're observing this nuanced shift towards what you could call selective cooperation. It's not just about who has the single best exclusive anymore.
And that's where it gets really interesting. We've seen Xbox on their official social media, amplifying a PlayStation Studios game like MLB The Show, and then PlayStation Spotlights, formerly Xbox-centric stuff like Sea of Thieves. I mean, that would have been unthinkable just a few years back.
Completely.
So why now? Why this sudden, almost corporate frenemy situation? What's driving this truce?
Well, the financial models have completely diversified. Look at Microsoft with its huge acquisitions, Activision, Blizzard, Bethesda, right? And the growth of Game Pass. They're now targeting what they call total engagement minutes across all platforms. It's not just unit sales on one console, one specific CPU anymore. And Sony, meanwhile, is strategically putting its first-party games onto PC now. And MLB The Show, well, that's developed by a PlayStation studio, but it appears day and date on Xbox. That's largely driven by MLB licensing, wanting broader reach.
So it sounds like this isn't just random goodwill. There's a very clear, evolving business logic here.
Precisely.
It really feels like it's eroding that psychological moat exclusivity used to build. These cross-platform titles, they're almost like retention insurance, aren't they?
That's a great way to put it.
If you, the user, see your main console as the hub where everything still shows up, your churn, risk the chance you'll cancel or leave, definitely drops.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we can't ignore the regulatory side either, right?
Right.
With all the scrutiny over industry consolidation after those big acquisitions.
Big time.
Platform giants kind of have to demonstrate openness, multi-platform goodwill, just to counter those narratives about anti-competitive foreclosure.
That's a critical observation. It aligns perfectly with this new subscription era logic, where, you know, frictionless discovery, making it super easy for you to find and play games, now fundamentally outranks purist territorialism.
Right.
Consoles are being reframed. Less walled gardens, more versatile gateways. And that public demonstration of openness, especially with antitrust reviews happening, it subtly counters those anti-competitive claims. It's good PR, frankly.
Speaking of subscriptions, let's talk Game Pass. Your sources highlight a really interesting move, Nine Sols joining the Xbox Game Pass standard catalog. What's significant is it's the first standard tier-only edition since, what, August 20th?
Yeah, that's the key detail.
And Nine Sols, for anyone listening, it's a hand-drawn 2D action platformer, Red Candle Games. Sounds cool, blends Sekiro-style deflection, Hollow Knight exploration, Taoist sci-fi.
It looks fantastic.
But why just standard tier? That feels deliberate.
It absolutely is. This signals Microsoft's clearly experimenting with how each Game Pass tier feels, its identity. Think like Netflix plans, right? Basic, standard, premium. Microsoft's trying to give each Game Pass tier its own personality after restructuring. You've got core for multiplayer and a small catalog, standard for a broader console library without the day one first party hits, and ultimate is the everything tier.
Okay.
So to stop standard feeling like just the middle option, it needs its own curated identity. Nine Sols fits that perfectly.
So why is specifically standard only? Is it about differentiating, giving standard its own unique appeal, like a premium indie vibe?
Precisely. Differentiation is huge. Since standard doesn't get those day one blockbusters, elevating premium feeling indies like Nine Sols gives it a unique editorial flavor. It's curated. And another key factor is retention engineering.
Dope.
A carefully chosen mid-season exclusive like this can reduce churn spikes. You know, those times players might think about canceling after a big game they wanted as launch is a fresh reason to stick around.
And from a business angle, is Microsoft kind of testing the waters, gathering data?
That's a key takeaway, yeah. By gating a desirable title like Nine Sols, they can quietly test engagement deltas, see how it performs when it's just on one tier, not everywhere at once.
Right, learn more about what works where.
Exactly. So expect more indie prestige, stylized AA experiments, narrative gems, maybe sharp 2D or tactics games, becoming the seasoning that keeps standard sticky. While Ultimate sells on breadth and cloud, it's nuanced curation.
Now let's pivot to something less positive. Pokemon Unite's unexpected exit from Belgium and the Netherlands.
Yeah, that was a surprise.
The news is it will permanently end support there on November 30th. Server shutting down. No official reason given, which always makes you wonder.
Always.
What's the unspoken why behind pulling a popular live service game like that?
It's an intriguing one, but the likely drivers. They probably circle around regulatory friction, monetization structure, and the cost-to-scale calculus. When a successful live game selectively leaves specific European markets, it's rarely random. Belgium, for instance, has had a famously strict stance on loot boxes since 2018, classifying certain paid random rewards as gambling.
Right, I remember that.
And the Netherlands has also had waves of enforcement and, you know, legal reinterpretation around these systems.
And Pokemon Unite, it isn't like a super aggressive gacha game where you're constantly rolling for characters.
Yeah, not primarily.
But it does have premium currencies, AOS gems, and layered reward loops, energy systems, item enhancers, those cosmetic hollowware things. How could those cross the line?
You've hit the nail on the head. Depending on the local legal interpretation, these systems, especially anything offering randomized rewards or progression tied to real money, can bump up against those paid chance definitions. So the expense of tweaking the game or carving out special compliant versions just for those relatively smaller markets probably made pulling out the more economically pragmatic choice. To avoid potential fines or legal fights, it's a tough calculation, balancing compliance cost against player base size.
So it's about avoiding fines or major redesigns for a smaller audience. Makes sense. Okay, moving from regulatory shadows to strategic team-ups. Capcom's rolling out a month-long Street Fighter VI event celebrating Monster Hunter Wilds. Kicked off September 1st.
Yeah, I saw that.
Bringing themed avatar gear, challenges, cosmetics into SF6. So while Pokemon Unite retreats, Capcom is actively building bridges. What's the strategy behind this kind of crossover?
Well, what's really smart here is how Capcom's using this as an engagement bridge. It hits multiple targets at once. First, obviously, it lifts awareness for the upcoming Monster Hunter Wilds, kind of like a pre-release hype campaign baked into another game.
Right.
But it also refreshes Street Fighter VI's own live service rhythm with new layered reward loops, gives current players fresh stuff to do.
Right, it works both ways. It could re-engage lapsed SF6 players before the holidays, give them new goals.
Exactly. And it frames Monster Hunter Wilds not just as a sequel, but as part of the bigger Capcom ecosystem.
Plus, you just know it's going to generate buzz on social media, right?
Yeah.
People sharing screenshots of their crazy hybrid costume.
Oh, yeah. Guaranteed viral potential there. Amplifies reach way beyond the usual channels.
So what kind of items are we talking? Like actual gear?
Expect avatar gear evoking those iconic Monster Hunter looks. Horn helmets, scaly armor, maybe even weapon transmogs.
Transmogs.
Yeah, just cosmetic skins for your gear in Street Fighter doesn't change stats. Purely visual. Plus, emotes, titles, photo modes, stickers, stuff for the Battle Hub social boards. It's all about letting players express themselves, which is key for retention in these games. And Capcom usually does this well, offering a low skill path for basic cosmetics and a mastery path for the fancier variants, often with a bit of FOMO, fear of missing out, to encourage daily check-ins. Very smart engagement loop.
Makes perfect sense. Okay, let's transition to Rainbow Six Siege X. Operation High Stakes is its third seasonal refresh of 2025. This kind of regular update cadence is crucial for live service games, isn't it?
Absolutely vital.
What makes Ubisoft Montreal's approach here with this incremental disruption stand out?
Well, Operation High Stakes is textbook Ubisoft Montreal. Their whole philosophy is incremental disruption.
Yeah.
Change just enough to re-energize tactical problem solving, but without completely wrecking the esports muscle memory that the pros rely on.
Ah, okay. Delicate balance.
Very. And these mid-year seasons, they carry extra weight. They test retention after the initial hype of the year has maybe cooled off a bit, keep things fresh, but stable.
And the headline item is always the new operator, right? Anchoring the marketing.
Always the hook.
This one's apparently designed to fit into that ongoing arms race around tempo control.
Yeah.
Emphasizing utility, risk reward, not just pure shooting skill.
Yeah.
It feels very Siege.
Yeah, it maintains that identity. It's more about information and timing than just aim duels.
But you mentioned that Quiet MVP might be the map overhauls.
Mm-hmm.
How do those reworks impact things?
Oh, they're huge. Full new maps are rare now. Instead, these layered reworks deliver pathing clarity, safer spawn flow, fewer gotcha angles. High Stakes continues that. Trimming Defender Pixel holds those tiny unfair spots and adding micro-rotations to encourage more dynamic roaming.
So for pros, those subtle changes really shift how they approach a map.
Massively. Surgically altered lanes, change breach priorities, drone routes. It's like slightly changing the chessboard mid-game keeps the meta evolving.
Gotcha. And then there are the systemic refinements, anti-cheat, input lag, HUD tweaks, the stuff that doesn't make trailers
but. But they absolutely feed session stickiness. They build trust. Trust in fair play. Trust that your inputs register correctly. Exactly. Siege's competitive health has always depended on that trust. Operation High Stakes includes back-end detection improvements, pushed server-side to cut down cheat adaptation lag.
Okay, so smarter, faster cheat detection.
Basically, yeah. Using server-side algorithms heuristics to spot cheats quicker, cutting down that window where cheaters operate before getting caught. Even small improvements there really help maintain high MMR morale, keeps the top players invested.
Making sure players feel the game is fair. Crucial. Okay, let's peek into the future a bit, or at least at Valve's moves. There's a fresh Steam-related trademark filing, popped up just days after those Fremont leaks about potential new Valve hardware.
Mm-hmm. The rumor mill is churning again.
This is reigniting theories that a living room-focused device could be nearing a reveal. Yeah. What's Valve's track record here?
It certainly is reigniting theories. Valve's hardware approach, always been iterative, orthogonal, and stubbornly anti-hype. The Steam Deck was a huge success, right? A portable PC with a great curated UX created this brand adjacency opportunity.
But we also remember the 2015 Steam machines.
Oof, yeah. Those kind of stumbled. Fragmented OEM messaging, different companies making them inconsistently uneven performance, confused value proposition. It wasn't smooth.
So this new trademark, it's vague, but it suggests Valve wants option space.
Mm-hmm.
Protecting names, future-proofing, very Valve.
Classic Valve.
Yeah.
Anticipating, not announcing. They want options for potential multifunction systems down the line.
But how cautious are they usually about actually launching hardware?
Very. They typically wait until the software side, input APIs, UI scaling for TVs, quick resume features is absolutely production stable, rock solid. So this could hint at maybe a modular, media-focused Steam device for the living room, something that's learned the lessons from the Steam machine's failure, something that just works.
We'll have to wait and see on that one.
Okay,
from future glimpses to present-day glitches. Uh-oh. Reports that several Xbox insiders found their consoles became unresponsive after installing the latest preview build.
Yeah.
That sounds bad.
Yeah, digital brick wall scenario. It absolutely highlights the risk-reward balance of opting into those early access rings. Posts in the alpha and beta forums describe consoles failing to boot. Black screens, error loops like E100, E200. Yeah, worst case stuff for an early adopter.
And it really drives home that dilemma, doesn't it? You get new features first, but maybe break your console. A good reminder for you listening to weigh the pros and cons of early access. What's Microsoft doing?
No formal public postmortem yet, which is typical for these insider builds, but community mods are directing affected users to submit diagnostics, capture OS versions, standard procedure. They're gathering data to figure it out and fix it.
Okay, good. Now let's shift to our community focus, starting with a familiar enemy.
Scalpers.
Ah, yes.
Pre-orders for the first wave of Pokemon TCG. Phantasmal flames, almost instantly strained by automated purchasing. Rapid sellouts. This story feels depressingly familiar for Pokemon TCG fans.
It's a recurring nightmare, honestly. Community trackers flagged all the usual signs. Characteristic scalper patterns, uniform multi-unit orders, checkout times all synced up, and resale listings popping up at like two or three times the retail price within the hour. It's organized exploitation of demand.
There's a second ripple now forming, which is actually good news.
Some retailers are apparently auditing suspicious orders. There are anecdotal screenshots showing cancellation notices hitting accounts with those super fast, high volume buys.
Nice. Okay.
So potentially returning things like elite trainer boxes, booster bundles back to public stock, a small win for actual fans against the bots.
That is good news. Shows retailers are maybe getting more proactive. Gives genuine collectors a bit of hope.
Definitely. Moving to in-game community events. The last shiny treasure of Ruin Terror Raid in Pokemon Scarlet and Violet is live now through September 14th. It headlines a two-week window that also floods Paldea with themed mass outbreaks like Vulpix, Numel boosting shiny chances overall. But the main event is battling and trying to catch a shiny Chiyu. That's one of the legendary Ruin Guardians, normally shiny locked postgame. Now it's in a repeatable raid.
Big deal for shiny hunters.
So for those looking to snag this rare Pokemon, what's the strategy? Sounds like a tough fight.
Chiyu is dark fire. Hits hard with special attacks, but it's kind of frail defensively. First thing, verify its Terra type in the raid. That can change things up. Popular counters. Fluttermane is great. Fairy Stab moves hit hard. Calm Mind boosts it further. Bulky Clodsire can stall and resist its types. Grim Snarl for support with screens and parting shot. Armourouge with Flash Fire can absorb fire moves.
Well, strategic team building is key. And teamwork, I imagine.
Absolutely crucial for these high-level raids. Support roles are vital. Light Screen, Reflect, Snarl to reduce Chiyu's damage output. Timing your heal cheers matters. Don't just spam them. And in online lobbies, coordinate debuffs so you're not overlapping uselessly. It's about efficiency and keeping everyone alive.
Got it. Okay, before we wrap up our deep dive today, just a couple of quick community bites. For the sports fans listening, NBA 2K26 is out this week, September 5th.
Mm.
Features the usual My Career, My Team, My NBA modes, authentic gameplay with pro play. Another year, another massive sports title.
Yep, the cycle continues. Reliable seasonal content.
And for horror fans, Dead by Daylight is teasing Sinister Grace. It's their next mid-chapter update. New killer, new survivor, inspired by Thai folklore.
Oh, cool.
Communities buzzing about spirits like Krasso or Mainak potentially being the inspiration. Great to see them pull from different cultural mythologies.
Yeah, keeps things fresh and interesting.
Wow, what a journey today. We've really unpacked some fascinating shifts, haven't we?
We really have.
From that softening console rivalry, the Game Pass strategy tweaks, those unexpected regulatory hurdles for live games, even the ongoing fight against scalpers.
Yeah.
And it's just so clear this industry is constantly moving.
In connecting it all, what really stands out is how interconnected everything is. Business decisions driven by engagement and global regulations, tiny game updates reflecting huge strategic plans. It's all linked.
It really is. So as we look ahead, here's something to chew on. If those traditional rivalries are blurring into selective cooperation, what new, maybe even more surprising, alliances might pop up next?
Interesting question.
And how will that increasing demand for player-first flexibility, play what you want, where you want, how you want, keep shaping not just the games, but the platforms, the hardware itself.
And maybe even, what impact could decentralized communities eventually have on these huge corporate decisions?
Exactly. Lots to think about. We hope this deep dive gave you plenty of those aha moments and a clearer picture of the forces shaping your gaming world.